With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Guitar Nerds is sponsored by Music Nomad, our favorite guitar maintenance tool manufacturing masters. You should check them out on musicnomadcare.com or on social media with @musicnomadcare. Hello and welcome to the Guitar Nerds Podcast, the world's number one guitar podcast. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Matt Knight.
Hello there.
And from Reverend Guitars, returning once again, Ken Haas. Ken, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on again. How is everybody?
It's good. We're good. I'm good. I'm enjoying the getting back to having people on the podcast because we hadn't done it for a little while, Matt. We'd gone back to just having our regular hosts, and I had the wonderful Matt Oram from Fidelity Guitars on a couple of weeks ago. We don't do the interview thing sort of as much as like Tone Mob. Have that as, and Blake really has that as a backbone. But it's lovely to have back, the people we really like. So,
Ken, I think you were the first and last person we interviewed just as we went into, the black hole of the last 2 years. This feels like a fresh start as things feel somewhat normal again.
One of the reasons, other than to just catch up with you, Ken, and all things Reverend, it's also a very important year for Reverend Guitars because you're celebrating your 25th anniversary, which seems very long. That seems like an extraordinarily long time for a company I still think of as being, very young and sprightly, which I guess in guitar terms, 25 years is a sort of young and sprightly amount of time, but it feels like a big number.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, right? Because we compete with or share the marketplace with so many legacy brands, and even like we don't really compete with Martin, but they've been around for 350 years, and and there's other musical, like Zildjian's been around for like 1100 years or whatever it is, and Gibson's been around for like 3000 years. when compared to a lot of the legacy brands, we are just, we're in primary school still, right? It seems like. It is 25 years. It is amazing to me. And it's incredible to me, like, how much all of our lives have changed in the last 25 years, no matter who you are. That's just like I don't want to be all like hippy dippy about it or whatever, but I'm also 52. So I was quite a bit different when I was 27 and this company was founded. And I started working for the company when I was 29. And things have changed.
Yeah, I mean the company in itself has gone through such a huge evolution from plastic body custom shops. Even in the sort of the relocation of the company.
Yeah, I think a little bit of that is healthy, right? One of the things that they say. They say in business that there's big milestones. Obviously, 25 is a big milestone. But I mean, when you're starting a new business, if your new business lasts a year and then your new business lasts 5 years, those are big milestones because 98% of new businesses or something like that fail within that time frame. And then they say if your business cracks $1 million in sales, which I don't know what's going on with the pound, and we're not here to talk about modern monetary theory, but I think $1 million is like 12 pounds now or something. I don't know. Whatever. but they say once you cross that milestone, that's like an accomplishment, you know? And now, Ian, we crossed that milestone like back in 2005 or six or something for the first time. And really? Now we're sitting here like 25 years into this, and it seems like what we've arrived, right? Like at 25. Yeah, it does. It still seems new to me in my mind. And it's one of my favorite things. I tell this story all the time. One of the things that makes me the happiest is when I go to a guitar show here in the States. Like we frequent the Dallas International Guitar Festival quite a bit. That's, you know, open to the public, and it's a great show. And when we were over in Birmingham a couple of years ago, where I met you guys face to face for the first time, I love it when I'm in an event like that and somebody comes up to me and says, "What's this? I've never heard of this. What's Reverend Guitars?"
Really?
You know, and that happens often enough that, you know, part of me wants to go, "Oh crap, our marketing department is failing." And then part of me, right? Because I'm, but then part of me, it gets so excited because there's so much more, there's so many more people in the industry that we have to reach, you know, people who are really into it who still aren't seeing us. And I don't want to just sit here and talk and monopolize all your time, but this is an interesting concept, and I'd like to hear your take on this. So you know how it is, because I can remember being this way. Before I started working for Joe in the late 90s, I can remember in the early 90s, when Fender and Gibson were really having their sort of like heyday, like their sort of redo, you know, they had their quality issues in the 70s and a lot of really good brands came along to compete with them in the 80s. And then they sort of figured out how to compete back. And by the early 90s, both of those companies were making pretty good guitars again. And I was really into the Fender, like American Standard series at the time or whatever. And I can remember being an early 20 something or a mid 20 something and going into a music store. And if they didn't carry either of those brands, I was like, well, this isn't a real store. Like I can remember thinking that and having like the sort of blinders on, like you're into, you know, we talked about this before. I'm like into Ibanez and I'm into Spensa and I'm into a lot of, I just like guitars, man. I like them all. And I like just all vintage stuff or whatever. And when you have the stuff that you're into and you walk into a store or you walk into a guitar show and you're just kind of looking for the stuff that you're into and you don't even see things that might be right in front of your face that are really cool. If once you get into that mode, and I was in that mode for a long time. And so, and I still sort of fight with that. I still want to like go to a trade show and see like, well, what's, you know, what are the new creatives coming out with? Like what's happening here? Does that make sense to you guys?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I feel like that all the time because there was even something on this podcast I was going to ask you about that I knew would make me feel like there'd been something in front of my face that I'd missed. And I'll tell you what it is, but we'll talk about it maybe later if we get time. I wanted to talk to you about car amps because the only time I've ever seen them was in videos that you shoot. And I'd just never come across them before. And then, you know, I'll look them up and check them out and I'll be like, oh, they're like really, really well established. And here are all these reviews that every single major publication has done on them for years. And I'm like, they just passed me by. It happens all the time. There's so much stuff out there. If you're not keeping a really broad view of everything, a real panoramic of everything that's going on, it's so easy to get locked into just the things you like. And especially Ken, like, you know, I'm the same as you. I really like vintage stuff. I spend a lot of my time obsessing over vintage stuff, and that means I miss a lot of the cool new things that come out.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, I think, I quite often walk into many guitar shops and just, I'm like, oh, they've got Gibson, they've got Fender, and they're the only things you see, and to your comment there about, oh, if they didn't stock Fender or Gibson, they weren't a real shop. And now I'm just thinking, oh, if they stock Fender and Gibson, they're sort of just the same as everyone else.
Right. And that's 30 years. 30 years has done that. That's just a time.
Yeah, and I actually think from, someone who works, in the industry, from another brand, I think it's really easy for you to get blinkered about what people perceive of your brand. Like you say, someone comes up to the Reverend booth and is like, oh, what's this? And like, I still speak to people going, oh, I hadn't seen this Boss pedal that you'd released. And I'm like, it's been out for 2 years. And you just forget that actually there's so many people you can talk to, and there's so many great people out there who are waiting to pick up your guitar for the first time, one of your guitars for the first time, and go and do something with it. And that's an incredibly exciting prospect to go. The person who's never heard of our brand before could go and buy one, and they could make the next, great guitar tone that makes it onto an album. I think that's so exciting, rather than going, oh, well, everyone knows about our brand. And if you ever get to that point, you've kind of peaked. Like, you can't sell anymore because everyone knows, and if they know about it, they would have bought one. So
yeah, and we have a lot of that, because the in the last 25 years, and the other thing that trips me up here sometimes too, is we've obviously done a lot of things. And so somebody who is just gotten into our brand over the last few years, and they start getting into stuff, and then they'll see a guitar that we don't make anymore. And we get a lot of questions about things that we don't make anymore. And I constantly have to remind myself, because I have to tell people, well, it's an evolution. And we're always like, Naylor is always working on the guitars. And even guitars that we have that we've been selling for many years, I don't know, our Double Agent model, for example, or our Club King model or whatever, specifications have changed quite a bit over the last 15 years, say, that we've had those models out, or 18 years or 20 years. Good Lord, time flies. And with that, there's a reason for that, and some of that is, well, the market is, has leaned a little bit. Like, if you would have told me 15 years ago that we were going to have Roasted Maple necks on all of our bolt-on models, I would have said, what the hell is Roasted Maple? And it was around, but it wasn't anything that was sort of widely available or accepted, or even really what the benefits of it were going to be, like they are. Mm-hmm. Now, so little things have changed, and one of those questions that is easy for me to get frustrated is when somebody says, well, why don't you do this thing that you used to do anymore? And it's easy to get frustrated when you get that question a lot, because like you said, with the Boss thing, well, in your mind, you're like, but we do this now, but really what you need to remind myself is you need to be flattered, right? Because I'm really glad that you like that. And here, and let me tell you why we don't do it anymore, and why we're doing, this instead or whatever. And then always take, people's considerations and people's opinions into consideration, because
absolutely. And that's
because nothing has to go away forever. we're not currently making a Manta Ray model, but boy, we have an idea, and we just need time to realize it.
It's funny that you mentioned that. Even I think like last week you did a live stream that I was watching about, it was the 25th anniversary live stream that you did. And when you start taking questions at the end, I think like the first question was about, I can't remember what model it was now, but it was about a model that was discontinued after you'd spent 20 minutes talking about like the three 25th anniversary models,
It's fine. I know, it happens. But it's always a work in progress, There are legacy models that I think we'll always make, of course, but I don't think that we should just you don't make the same three guitars in the same three colors forever and ever and ever. It's got to sort of ebb and flow, and we want to keep it interesting. And as technology changes, as time goes on, you know, Joe's ideas change. And what Joe thinks works, like we have this new Billy Corgan model, right? You guys probably have that down to get to in this broadcast.
Absolutely. Well, let's do that now.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, but that plays into this. So, when we did the BC One and we launched it in 2015 or 16, it absolutely suited all what Corgan wanted in electric guitar in that moment. And if you were to ask Corgan about it now, he still maintains that the first Billy Corgan signature model is the ultimate guitar for him to record modern guitar sounds. He loves it.
Right.
And when he's going into the studio to write new music, that's what he plays. And as a matter of fact, the Pumpkins just put out a whole bunch of stuff of him in the studio playing the original signature model, which is interesting because we're in the middle of this big blitz for round two. But I think that's awesome because we have every intention, I never say never, we have every intention of offering that original model with those original pickups, both in Reverend and Railhammer for the time being, because there's still enough interest in them. And it's so unique looking and it's become a brand identifier. That first Billy Corgan model with those pick guards, I see references to that everywhere, right? It's a thing.
Yeah.
As time went on, Billy touring more, and of course, when a band like the Smashing Pumpkin goes out on tour, now he's got 30 years worth of material that he needs to choose from when he plays a gig. And I've heard him make the sort of human jukebox joke. But he's, you know, he has to go back and do some of these older songs because that's what rock concert stuff is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We all know how it works. And if, you know, somebody went to see the Smashing Pumpkins and they didn't hear, you know, Cherub Rock or whatever, they'd be bummed. So he's an entertainer and he's there to make people happy. So what Billy found is when he was playing songs off of his first two or three records with the modern guitar, that he was missing something. Like, he was getting too much mid-range out of his signature model to use on some of those older things. And now with the modern gain structure that he likes, the heavy mids are perfect. But with the older gain structure that he's trying to mimic, as he's trying to mimic the sound from stuff off of Melancholy or whatever, he was struggling with the new guitar. And so he started to play the exact guitars that he toured with back then, you know, to mimic that tone. And when questioned, you know, and Joe and I, he's Billy Corgan. Like, people have really, really funny ideas about how signature stuff and artist relations work. You know, we didn't go to Billy Corgan and say, "Hey man, you can't play those guitars anymore," because that's insane. He's Billy Corgan. Like, he can play whatever the hell he wants to play. I mean, that's just, it is what it is. You know what I mean? But we did ask him the question, is there something that our guitar is not hitting for you that is making you, you know, do that, go back to those older guitars? And he explained it to us. And Joe said, "Well, we'd like the opportunity to address that." And Corgan was like, "Yeah, I mean, have at it, you know." And then this new instrument came out of that conversation. Hence us using Alder for the body wood for the first time in the company's history. And then we made some tweaks to the pickups to have them hit a little bit more of the highs and the lows, without having the mid-range be so spiked or pronounced. And Joe nailed it. I mean, that is why Joe is our designer. And that is that he can hear what Billy Corgan was describing, and then he knows how to change the physical attributes of the guitar to hit what Corgan was looking for. And so now we have a second Corgan signature model, and he's using it. He loves it. I mean, it's obviously out there, and he got it out there before we got it released, you know, which is a great problem to have. The fact that he was so happy with it, that he, you know, paraded it out there for such a long time before we really got it going is a huge compliment in itself. So So the signature model thing is a work in progress, right? Gabrels is the same way. You know, he was doing one thing, and then as he got the Cure gig, he was doing another thing, and the Space Hawk came along.
I can't even keep track of how many signature things he has.
and then he'll have an idea. Well, I'm doing this gig, and I could really use a guitar that does this. And it's a good idea, you know, and you're like, yeah, okay, we'll do a fourth model for you. But it's because it's a good idea. It's a cool, that Dirt Bike Royale is a really cool guitar. And we're not doing anything really quite like that in the line. So it fills a niche for us while it's filling a niche for Reeves. And so going forward with it makes sense. And it should be a work in progress, right? Like you shouldn't be, I don't know, man. As these guys, as their careers develop or go forward, and Reverend, you know, goes forward through 25 years, you know, the needs of us here are changing. The needs of our players are changing. The age of our artist roster is changing as we start to work with a lot of younger guys and a lot of younger women. And we hear, you know, feedback. People want this. People want that. Somebody's looking for something specific. And we want to do that. You know, we want to work with younger players and give them what they're looking for. So you will see changes in the line. And so the trick is, of course, is to try to make everybody happy, right?
iZotope and Native Instruments have teamed up to create the start-to-finish bundle that home recording guitar nerds have been waiting for. Plus, you, dear listener, get an extra 10% off with Guitar Nerds by using discount code NERDS10 at the checkout on iZotope.com. From the creative spark to the final touch, their new bundles include pretty much everything you could possibly need, which is great because it's far too easy to sink hundreds of pounds and a big chunk of your time into just picking up random plugins. The Music Production Suite 4.1 and Complete 13 bundle contains over 30 intelligent mixing, mastering and repair plugins, 65 premium instruments, 20 plus expansions and over 35,000 sounds. And if that's a bit basic for you, they've also bundled Music Production Suite 4.1 with Complete 13 Ultimate, which gives you everything that makes Complete 13 incredible, plus a colossal library of added synths, sampled instruments and effects, 115 plus premium instruments and effects, 39 native instruments expansions and over 65,000 sounds. Whew. It sounds like a lot. It is. It's very good, very comprehensive. And as we've come to expect from iZotope, it's very good value. If you're looking to get into home recording, I cannot recommend it more highly. And if you're already into home recording, it really is the one-stop shop for making what you do sound better. This podcast is entirely treated and produced using iZotope plugins, and Native Instruments have been responsible for almost every synth or sample you've heard on our Guitar Nerds jingles. Check out their great new bundles on iZotope.com or follow links in the description of this podcast and use discount code NERDS10 at the checkout for 10% off anything in the iZotope arsenal.
Well, I mean, you know, Reverend must have one of the largest signature model ranges of any brand, I would imagine, at the moment.
So. And they're freakishly weird, too. I'm really proud of that. I think it's awesome that there's so many like unique.
Yeah, it's so broad, it's so diverse, the range of signature models. I mean, it's almost like even the way sort of you present signature models as an idea on the website, it's like its own thing. It's like these are guitars, these are basses, and these are signatures. They're like an entire category of their own because there are just so many.
And they're supposed to. In my mind, like a signature model is supposed to be specific to the artist who's playing it, right? Like when we do these things, it's not, I think the last time I was on with you guys, I talked at length about Mike Watt's bass. And we've done a sort of we've added to that with a bass, a Mark II, he's calling it. And that is, it's the same as the Corgan story. I mean, he went out and toured a bunch with the Mark I, and then he had this idea for one of the bands that he was working in where the band gets very, very quiet. And he was looking for a sort of a different tone that he could switch back and forth to. And we sort of came up with working with him, came up with the idea for the Mark II bass. And that was born out of him playing the original model for a few years. And then he's like, hey, let's try this. But even before we got to that point with Mike, when I originally asked him about doing a signature model, he was like, well, I like your basis, but I really do my own thing. Well, yeah, it's your own thing that we want to address.
Yeah, yeah. You're not just asking him to do a custom color in one of your existing models.
I love when that happens. You know, the Matt West thing, you know, your guy from Wales over there. I called him your guy. I don't know if we even know him.
We're all friends.
That's actually the guitar you have, isn't it? That's the Revenant.
Yeah, exactly.
You have,
I think.
Yeah,
I think it's
my favorite. Yeah, because and he got a Jetstream 390 from me, a couple of them, and was touring with Neck Deep, and he called me and said, "I love this guitar. I'm never going to play another guitar. I have found my home. This is it." And he said, if this guitar only had a bridge pickup and a reverse headstock, it would be the perfect guitar. And he said that to me, and he had a signature. It was the fastest we went from, hi, how you doing, to signature model in the history of the company. Because this was like a week later, and I was like, as soon as he said that, I saw it in my head and was like, oh, dude, I'll make that. That sounds great. It really, because I wanted one.
Yeah.
And it's just a super cool stripped down, you know, rock guitar. It's a great instrument. It's a lot of fun to see it out there. So in his case, we have something that's more just different features of something that we're offering in the line already, you know? And then to the other end of the spectrum where, you know, we have stuff like that we do with Reeves or Watt, yeah, or Billy.
The Gristle 90.
Yeah, did it right. And the Gristle 90, yeah, where we just started from the ground up. We didn't have that. Last time I talked to you, the Gristle 90 was delayed a lot by all of that COVID stuff.
Yeah, just had the standard one at that point. But I think just to finish that off, I think, like you said, it's really good that just to go, I guess they say like performance is a moving scale. And I kind of feel that with guitars and what you're doing is, it's like you've got to move forward, because if you make the same three models, you're only catering to the people that want those three models now, and then for the next 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and then all of the new people have gone, well, I'm playing this. And if you can offer a lot of signatures, and I think you said that a lot of artists, it's their idea, and actually that idea fills a gap in your product range anyway, or fills an idea that's just not out there in the world, that's again moving guitars forward. And I think that's what we need more of, realistically, you know, to see artists going, and for you and the team to be more open to go, I want to do this, and I think we need to do this because it's gonna bring something new to guitar, and that's only going to just drive the industry forward. And I think that's such a great thing to be able to do. And just sort of like, I guess in some ways, like no holds barred when it comes to what the artist wants to do in initial conversations. I'm sure there's some crazy ideas out there, but, you know, you always land on something.
Yeah. I mean, for the most part, I mean, when you're working with, I'm not going to make, you know, weird, so, I mean, something that's too outlandish. I'm not interested in making like a lightning bolt guitar body or anything like that, or you know what I mean? For the most part, the people that we work with are attracted to us because of what we're doing to begin with. So then the ideas that they have, you know, sort of coincide or fit in with our brand, as it were, you know, fit in with what we're doing as a brand, because they already like us, you know, they already like what's happening here. Which is cool. Yeah. You know, working with the Greg thing was really fun. I didn't really think about that. I mean, right in January of 2020, Naylor and I went to Fishman to develop the Gristle 90 pickups.
Oh, really?
along with the Fishman people. So that became a very specific thing. So Greg really liked our P90s, right? And you really like Naylor's P90s, our whatever we call them, HA90, I believe. I'm really bad with like letters and numbers and stuff. but they, so when we prototyped Greg's guitar, we obviously didn't have Fishman pickups to put in it. So we prototyped his guitar with our pickups and got the guitar to Greg for his approval. And he played it and he loved it. And then he wanted to, you know, he was talking to Fishman about them developing a signature set of soap bar style, P90 style pickups for him. And now we had a platform to sort of test them in. And so what went on for, you know, right, like us in early 2020, we went out with a couple different versions of this guitar and dialed in Greg's pickups to basically sound like ours, because he thought the guitar sounded great, you know, and so we didn't want to stray too far from that. And the Fishman people, the way they EQ the Fluence stuff is really cool. I mean, it's a very modern product, you know, as you know. I mean, it's quite a bit different from a standard, you know, a standard passive magnetic pickup or whatever. And so we were able to EQ those pickups in real time, which is a fascinating thing to take part in. And I'm so glad Naylor was there, because Naylor and Greg and the gentleman from Fishman who were doing this together, you know, imagine sitting at a laptop and listening to Greg play and changing the EQ of the pickups in real time.
Yeah, it's rad, dude.
It's really cool.
That's very weird. That's super sci-fi stuff.
It really was. It was a really interesting thing to just be a fly on the wall and be like, wow, this is really something. And you know, they nailed it. It's what they do.
It's a fantastic guitar. I mean, you must be so proud of it. And I'm sure Greg is too. But it is
so cool. Yeah, it's so much fun. And Greg is so much fun. I mean, obviously. So the whole – that was also a very successful thing that we've done since the last time I talked to you. It's just been – a hoot, you know.
Yeah.
It won the Gristle 91 Best Guitar Nerds Guitar of last year, I think. It was Adrian Thorpe who won it, who I don't think Adrian Thorpe from Thorpe EFX was one of our guest judges on it. Now, I don't think he'd seen it before we started doing the podcast series, and when I share around the link for each guitar, and I think whatever I'd sent him, he wasn't into the color, and he was a bit, you know, he was on the fence about it. And then he found I can't remember what the color was, he found another color option for it, and went from being lukewarm about it to purchasing one off of Anderton's whilst we were podcasting. so it won an account of that, but it's a great guitar.
I guess one question I had, you talking about all this and talking about the industry moving forward, and obviously you coming on board, what, 2 years into Reverence history, or, you know, a few years. So what was Naylor's vision when he started, and when you first started going, you know, going around to shops and being like, oh, we're trying to sell, I don't know, 10 guitars or whatever, and like, oh, it'd be great if we made this model one day, to, you know, where you're sitting now going, did you ever see the business being where it is now 25 years ago?
With the original guitars, I mean, it was a tough sell. They were pretty outside the box, but the whole idea from the start was Joe wanted to make, like, it sounds so cliche, because everything does in this business when you break it right down, right? But I mean, Joe wanted to make affordable working man guitars, like, you know, for your weekend warrior cover guy, you know, or original music bar gig guy that has the day job, and when he wants to be able to have a professional grade quality instrument that stays in tune, that gets the tones that he's looking for at an affordable price. And as time has gone on, you know, I mean, that whole thing, that, you know, custom shop quality but with affordability. And one of the ways that he addressed that at the very beginning was those original phenolic bodied guitars. We were able to assemble them without any paint. And that really cut down on the cost of the instrument. Where it shot us in the foot, I think, in our initial original marketing, was then we would go out and present these guitars and basses to people. My good friend, Johnny Cola from Long Island, New York, was working with us at a guitar show in Long Island in like 1999 or 2000. And he was showing basses to a bunch of dudes. And there were a bunch of dudes. And they came around and they were just ripping away on one of our basses at the time. And Johnny says, you know, I mean, $1,000, you can be taking that to a gig. And this guy's response was, I'd be laughed off the stage if I showed up at a gig with a $1,000 bass, but this thing plays and sounds every bit as good as the thing that I'm using. And so there's so many weird perception things that come into play right in this business. But that was a real eye-opener for us. It was like, oh, that's odd, you know? And so it as we started going forward and trying to sort of hit that niche, with the phenolic bodies, it wasn't happening. I would show them to bigger artists and they would look at me and they'd be like, oh, I'm not into the Dano thing, or I'm not into the plastic thing or whatever. And it would be like, well, you really need to try this and hear how it plays and how, you know, lightweight it is and the tone of it and staying the tune, you know, the tuning stability and all that kind of stuff. And they'd just say, yeah, but I'm not really into that, the way it looks or whatever. And be like, okay.
Right.
And so, you know, we experimented with a lot of things. And when we finally settled on having Mir Music in Korea build some prototypes for us, and we got some prototypes of some original designs that Joe had going, and I started showing those to artists, I could see it clicking with people immediately. I mean, it was just like sort of taking Joe's aesthetic but having a more traditional build for the electric guitar. Immediately the tide sort of changed, and while we were proud of what we had done up to that point, we could tell that its days were numbered the second we started bringing in Chargers and Jetstreams. The writing was on the wall. And then to go out and see people be excited about what we were starting to do was very, very exciting for Joe and I. But the mission didn't change. So the mission was to provide that guitar that can go out and play every weekend, can go out on tour and be played night after night after night, and have that guitar that you are seeing Robin Fink from Nine Inch Nails play, or that you're seeing Shade from Code Orange play, when you go and then you go to the store, you get online to buy that guitar, you're buying that exact guitar that they're playing. They're not up there with some $8,000 hand-built made out of wood from a tree that Naylor peed on when he was a child, custom version of that, whatever goofy thing is, you know? No, I mean, these guys are up there. I had a great story, you know, about The Cure. They had a bunch of equipment get wet on a tarmac going through customs. A customs agents in a country which shall remain nameless opened up a bunch of stuff and left it open in the rain. Can you believe that? Oof. And they got to Chicago to play Riot Fest, and Reeves needed a guitar. And I called up Chicago Music Exchange, and they grabbed a couple of Jetstreams. They didn't have any of his signature models in stock at the time. And they grabbed a couple of Jetstreams off the wall and took them over to Reeves, and he played them at Riot Fest. And they're still in the Cure traveling rig, by the way. I still see one of those guitars every once in a while and giggle. But I mean, that's the point, though, you know, is that we've, you know, that these guitars are good enough to be doing that. And so there's trade-offs, you know, as far as the, nothing serious, obviously, you know what I mean, but the build quality and the tuning stability and the electronics and all that stuff are there. It's a pro-level instrument in every way. And yeah, we might not have, you know, the fanciest, you know, 10, 5A flame, blah, blah, whatever, you know, whatever all that stuff is. I might not have that stuff available, but there's people that do that and do that really, really well, you know, like we might have some fun and like, you know, pick on, and like everybody does in this industry, you pick on the people that do the high end stuff. You know what I mean? You've got this like crazy $30,000 Les Paul and you like point and giggle at it, or some crazy like PRS thing. And you're like, oh, you know, well, that's not made for play. But I like all that stuff. You know, I like all the, like,
You like the dentist guitars.
Oh,
as well,
man, I like the dentist guitars. They're super cool. And they drive an end of this industry that is amazing. You know what I mean? And that's a really cool thing. And I like I said, I want my guitar to in a lot of cases, my guitar will play better and stay in tune better and sound better than a lot of that stuff, you know?
The time has come on this week's podcast to hear some gear. So let's check out some of the complete amplification and effects solutions available from Neural DSP and their plugins. We've teamed up with Neural DSP a bunch over the last year or two. Matt and I are big fans of what they do, and we'd like you to become a part of that. So use discount code, that's right, it's a discount code, GuitarNerds at NeuralDSP.com for 30%, a whopping 30% off of any of their plugins. It's worth noting that you get a 14-day free trial with any of their plugins with no credit card required. So if you just want to see what all the fuss is about, you've got a whole 2 weeks on them with any of their amps and effects. Now, this week, I'm checking out the Omega Ampworks Granifier plugin suite. Now, Neural DSP described this suite as providing everything from dirty blues to crushing metal. This dark horse is sure to surprise you. And it sure did surprise me. I'm buzzing whilst I'm recording this this little ad. It's such a simple suite. It's one amp head based on the Omega Ampworks Granifier, one pedal, which the Earthquaker device's plumes, and yet I'm probably going to switch to using this amp for everything. The depth of tone, the articulation, the great low gain and high gain tones, the massive amount of fantastic artist and Neural DSP presets. It gave me a surprisingly vast collection of drive tones that I think are literally going to cover me for everything I do. Here's a track I built using only presets from the Omega suite. That's the Omega Ampworks Granifier plugin suite from Neural DSP. Check it out on neuraldsp.com and use discount code GuitarNerds at the checkout for 30% off any of their amp and effects plugins.
Sure, that's the whole backbone, isn't it? You've said it already, but it's about making workhorse instruments that you're maybe slightly less afraid to throw around, but that means you're going to get more out of it than if you're being super careful.
Yeah, and I get this call from artists a lot, and over the course of the last 25 years, I've heard this a bunch of times where a touring musician will call me and will say, I've been touring for the last 10 years with the 72 Tele that I got when I was a kid. And I think I want to retire it because it has so much sentimental value to me. I don't think I want to take it on the road anymore. And, you know, can I get, you know, a couple of East Siders from you or Greg Koch model or whatever the guitar that started that conversation was, or I have this old Junior that I've had forever and ever, and I want to take a Reeves Gabrels out or what, because I, you know, and I think that is, I have nothing but respect for that. I think that's bad to the bone. I think it's really cool that we can sort of fill that niche. But then, like you said, yeah. And then if they're, you know, if they have a problem somewhere, the guitar gets stolen, you know, these Billy Corgan Z1s, they're super cool and weird and sort of oddly specific or whatever, but the guitar that we're selling is the exact guitar that Billy's playing. So if Billy's over in Europe and something happened and his guitars get stolen, he can call up Anderton's or Merchant City or whoever the case, you know, whatever the case may be, and get one and keep going because it's going to go right to the stage.
Mm, Joe, we were actually talking about the same thing last week with Music Man, you know, and we actually went to the Music Man factory a couple of years ago. And again, the same thing, the guitars that come off the line are the same ones that go out to the artist. And if the artist makes a change, then the change goes into the production. And, you know, I think that just builds so much brand confidence, which, again, has been obviously a real plus point for you, and to have so many super high profile artists and players. But I think coming back to, you know, to your mission statement as well, I think it's been so good to see that actually there's been a rise and an understanding and a big appreciation for guitars that aren't made in America or in Japan. They're made in Korea or these other factories, and they're affordable and they're great, and people have been able to buy more than one guitar regularly. You know, guitars used to be a big and expensive purchase, and I think, you know, people would be like, oh, I really want a Fender, but if I'm going to buy one, I've got to buy an American one or whatever, you know. Oh, no, I would never play a guitar from, you know, over here. And you know, we often talk about on the podcast, you know, amazing Squires for $200 or whatever. And I think that's been the great thing for you guys, is $1,000 on average, you know, maybe a little bit more, a little bit less, but great solid consistency. And people were like, yeah, guitars from Korea are great. You must have been one of the first brands that really started to do it properly
and experimenting with finishes and things like baked maple. I feel that there were a lot of curves that you were slightly ahead of.
Yeah, and there's a lot of brands. There's a lot of good stuff made in Korea. That's, you know, and it's a difficult market. It's an interesting thing to discuss. And I told you earlier that I'm going to be heading over there next month to look at a few things, which I'm really interested in doing. But Korea largely, and this doesn't come as any surprise to anybody, but I mean, Korea is a first world economy country. And there's not a lot of difference with doing business in Korea and doing business in Japan, and as opposed to some other areas that are emerging, right? And so what we end up with in Korea is we're doing business there because the work is good and because the factory's been established. Our factory's been there for three generations, and they know what they're doing, and that's the reason why we're working with them. If that same factory with the same history was in Mexico or was in, I don't even know where else. If it was anywhere, I mean, I would want to look at that and talk to them or whatever. You know, it's because of a lot of reasons. It's difficult to do a startup here in the States doing stuff, doing what we're doing. And to do it in our price range is damn near impossible, which is one of the reasons why. And then we have ideas, and so our point is we want to find the person that is the best at realizing the ideas that we have. And it just so happens that Mir was the best one. And they made the necks and the pickups for the original guitar, so we had experience with them. So when we grew, it was an easy thing to sort of transition into. So we've been working with them for a very, very long time. And I think that's, you know, in America, there's this, like, you know, fear of globalization or something that's going on. And I don't understand that. And this is not the forum for politics. My interest is in selling guitars all over the world. And when you have a good product, then you're able to sell guitars all over the world. And so wherever in the world that you realize the sources for your product is what it is, you know, and electric guitars and guitars in general are very unique in that you're selling a sum of the parts, and the parts come from all over the place. I mean, Maple comes from Canada, and Carina comes from South America somewhere, or in Africa somewhere, depending on, you know, the limba tree and where you're sourcing your limba from. And mahogany obviously comes from different places, and rosewood comes from different places of the country. And then your electronics come from here, and the metal comes from here. And yeah, you break down any product that you have from any industry, And the way the world works is that we all have to sort of work together to make these things happen. And guitars are no different. I'm just, you know, I'm just happy to sit here and look at the end result and be like, damn, that's cool.
well, absolutely. Absolutely. And we, you know, we should talk about the three things that you've released for the 25th anniversary as well. Because I did think it was an interesting three choices.
It's funny how many people obviously we thought about it, but I'm surprised at how many other people have thought about it and want to talk to me about it. You know what I mean? So I'll just tell you what I think and tell me if you're sort of on board with that. So we wanted to sort of do a little bit of like modern and a little bit of classic. And so when it came to the bass, the Decision bass was the number one selling bass over the last...
Really? More than the Watt Plow? Oh, I guess it's been around longer than the Watt Plow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. But we made a conscious decision right up front to leave the Signature models out of this. You know, because it would have just been a cosmetic change to something that's already there. And yeah, we didn't. And then what do you do? How do you do that? How do you go to somebody? Well, we're going to offer your guitar in a 25th anniversary edition, but not yours. So it was either do one Signature model or do all, right? So we decided to leave the Signature stuff out of it. But Naylor, the color of the 25th anniversaries is our metallic silver frieze, which we've been doing for a number of years. So that was the only color available in the Reeves Gabrielle Sustainiac for a number of years. And then we've offered it in a few things, and it's been insanely popular in our Double Agent OG model. And
it's
so
a great color.
That was, yeah. And then, of course, silver is the anniversary, is the 25th anniversary color. So that was an easy fit.
And I love that everyone's calling it the blue one as well.
Yeah, right. I know. It's awesome. But the reason why they're doing that is because that aluminum. So the aluminum pickguard, Naylor liked the look of the aluminum pickguard on that color on the Billy Corgan Z1. So that was where we decided to pull the aluminum pickguard over to it. And then once you have that sort of matte aluminum finish next to the silver, it really does pull out the blue and the silver. Because you're seeing like more of a gray right next to it, you know. So I'm totally down with that blue one. I don't care, because it is. I mean, it's, we call it metallic silver frieze as a sort of homage to, you know, like the vintage color, like a, you know, ice color, whatever it is. And then so the Decision bass was chosen just on the popularity of that model. And then we wanted to do the six-gun HPP because it was a newer model to the line, and we wanted to do something that was now. You know what I mean?
Right.
Well, this is something that we just released within the last, you know, year and a half or whatever, and so we wanted to offer it on this. And then the Junior was just me going, damn, this color scheme would look so cool on the Junior, because the Junior pickguard with the swoop and the, you know, and then the single P90 with the ebony and the black headstock to set it off. And that was really, and then once I said that, like Naylor was like, oh yeah, that would be really cool.
Oh, that's the one for me out of the lineup. The Sensei Junior works so well in this finish. And also the lovely 12th fret inlay that you've gone for, the Roman numerals of 25. It just looks great. It looks fantastic, especially on the Sensei, I think.
I am glad you think so.
It is very cool. But I was surprised not to see the charger in there. Sort of.
Oh, like, I know. But you know, where do you stop?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's the point.
That, because at some point you have to go, okay. You know, no, but we offered a bass, and we offered a bolt-on, and we offered a set neck, and then here you go. We are going to keep them into the line as we move into next year, because we didn't make enough of them, and the demand has been overwhelming, so... we are going to be offering them a little bit into next year.
Oh, right. It completely as they are, still with 25 on the fretboard. Oh, that's awesome. That's really cool. I thought there'd be just, you know, super limited edition. So that's cool that you're kind of extending.
I think we went a little bit too limited on them, you know.
Right.
And I'm glad that people like them so much, because, I mean, I sure do. I kept one each. I'm known to do that. But I think it's important. One of the, you know, Joe, I tell this story a lot too, but Joe is very much like whatever we're doing now is what he's excited about. And in a lot of cases, he designs for himself. Like the Air Sonic is really the Joe Naylor signature guitar, because it fulfilled a bunch of things that he was looking for in an instrument that had never really been addressed before. And I think that that's really cool because Joe, you know, plays and records and writes and has things going on. And a lot of the instrument development comes directly from Joe's personal needs, right?
Right.
And so as Joe goes forward with that, he often doesn't think about his past. And Joe hasn't kept anything. Like Joe has no Joe has serial number one, which he actually sold. And the person who he sold it to got it back to him eventually because he thought it was important that Joe have it, which I think is fabulous. I wish he would have thought it was important that the company have it. But I'm glad that Joe has it because it's important. It's important. It's his legacy, you know. And me, I become a little more attached to things. I'm more of a hoarder, as it were. And of guitars in general, I have a absolutely stupid collection of instruments, but I've saved a lot of the things that we've done over the last 25 years, and I've saved a lot of firsts, you know, a lot of prototypes. And when we do an artist thing that I think is special or whatever, or it connects with me, you know, I have a lot of teardrop cases that are bagged up and tagged on shelves in the warehouse of things because I don't know. I think as a company goes forward, I think it's nice to be able to say, you know, yeah, I've got that here to look at if we want to reference something, or, you know, and then I take them out and play with them. So
do you think, you know, you talk about Joe designing for himself, and it reminded me of something that you said on the Ken and Greg show on your on the Reverend YouTube.
Oh, thanks for watching.
Oh, no, cool. Well, you've made it a whole three seasons now. It's been a full three seasons of that show, but you were talking about the HPP and about how I guess the early ones were more in HSS. The reason for going for HPP was because Joe didn't like the balance of a humbucker with single coils.
Yeah, it didn't make sense to him, and it's funny to me because I can see a place for both. Years ago, Joe did a model called the Commando. And the Commando had a full-size humbucker in the bridge and a lipstick pickup in the neck. And that guitar is so odd. And obviously there's like a surf caster influence there, maybe a little bit too, right? But the thing with that is, I used it in a band that I was in where I had to do this like acoustic strumming thing, but then I occasionally had to rip leads, and it was really, really, so it didn't matter that the pickups didn't balance because I was using two channel amps and I was playing the lipstick through the clean channel and the humbucker through the lead channel. So who cares? Right. And so I always thought of like the HSS or the HSH thing like that. If you think about how Vi uses, you know, I mean, the Gem has got to be one of the best-selling signature models of all time. And he's not worried about balance with the single coil because he uses those middle positions for completely different things. When you listen to his, you know, whether you listen to his records or listen to him live, you can hear the different tones that he's getting. And he has his rig set up to balance with that. But now what if you want to get single coil tones and you don't have a rig that's set up like that specifically for it, you know, and you've got this great like neck pickup lead sound that you like because you like a single coil neck pickup lead sound, but you switch to the humbucker and then you're completely blowing out your amp, you know, if you're using, you know, deluxes or cars or single coil things or whatever. And I think that's where Joe was coming from. With the HPP, we had done a couple of HSS custom runs for our friends here in the States at Wildwood Guitars. And Joe was playing around with the idea on the HSS of having the bass contour only work on the humbucker. So you could roll the bass contour completely off and then switch back and forth on the five-way switch
between the humbucker
and the two single coils and have a pretty well-balanced guitar. Really, it was an interesting concept. And then that sort of led him to, well, what if we took it the other direction? And then had those the mid-range presence of P90s in the middle and the neck. And it's, oh, wow, hey, that's, you know. And then we prototyped it. And I am, as I am talking to you, I am looking at the prototype hanging on the wall. Because I just love it. I just think the guitar absolutely rips.
It's a surprisingly uncommon pairing. Like, it doesn't sound unusual to say, like, you know, a humbucker and a pair of P90s, but I can't think of any others. I don't think there's any other glaring examples of, oh, I mean, you know, sort of just off the peg guitars with that pickup.
Yeah, we stumbled on something that works, and it works. The in-between settings on that guitar sound great, you know? And I'm not one in our traditional range for really worrying about like hum canceling and things of that nature. And I years ago modded I like Ibanez. Okay, everybody knows it. Never pick on me about it. All you want to people, it's fine. but my first guitar that I bought new was an RG570, and I used to really like the way a full-sized humbucker and a single coil sounded when they were turned on together. And one of the things that I did not like about those guitars was when you went to position two and position four, it killed a coil in the humbucker. And of course you got the full noise canceling thing, but it also, there was a phasing thing that happened there and you couldn't really hear the humbucker anymore. It sounded like you went from having a humbucker on in the bridge to having a pair of single coils. And I think there's something to be said for that full humbucker sound mixed with the middle pickup. I think it's cool. And I rewired my original RG570 to just have that, to leave the humbucker on full when I went to position two. And I would play that guitar in position two with full gain all the time. I thought it was just a killer. There was like an articulate thing that you would get that would cut through a ton of gain with that. And I get that with the six gun with the HPP. It's the same thing. You know, when you go to position two, the humbucker is still on. And so it sounds great. And we've done that all along. We did that with the Gil Paris model for 15 years, you know, before we got into the HPP thing. And that, you know, is just a preference of Joe and I. We just like the way it sounds. And so it's fun to bring it forward with that. So when you add that mid-range of the middle P90 to the humbucker in position two, you know, it goes from this like sort of strat on steroids thing that we say with our Jetstream 390 to this whole other weird sort of realm that sounds great with fuzz pedals because the extra mids sort of add articulation to fuzz pedals. And I mean, it's really just got a vibe of its own, you know, it's really cool. And I don't even know how you explain that to somebody that doesn't play guitar. Right. We've been having that conversation around here a lot lately is how do you explain all the different models to people who don't really play?
Oh, I've had that so many times when it comes to like guitar pedals and they're like, yes, it's a delay pedal. I'm like, yeah, but if you're picking up a guitar for the first time, no one's going to know what a delay pedal is. Oh, it's a multi-effects pedal. It's like, if you don't know what that is, like, how do you explain that? You know, you do forget that we do live in a pretty unique language.
We're nerds. We're nerds, man. Yeah. We're nerds.
Oh, I just got this Eventide black hole pedal. Played around with that. Wow.
Yeah, and you're just like, wow, what?
Wow. And right, and I'm a big fan of the Earthquaker Afterneath. Like, some of those reverbs, that's just my personal opinion. I think they're difficult in live situations because there's just so much, right? But for so much of what we do now, you know, with playing in the studio and demoing these products and doing this stuff, I love that big like reverb pad. I think it's really fun. And that black hole does that thing with that sort of that pre-swell thing that almost does like a delay. It's not reversed, but it's almost like you've added a little delay in or something. And I could just sit and screw around with that thing for hours.
I'm a big fan of that pedal. It's all the best bits all the best bits of the H9, but I can actually use them with rotary controls. Much, much, much better. I really like it.
We understand how that's different, right? And how that's not like one of those isn't like infringing on the other thing, you know? No. They're different things, even though they're both like these big, huge reverbs. And I was having this whole conversation about like other things that are going on in the industry right now, which shall remain nameless, you know? But like Hyundai doesn't release a new like Santa Fe SUV. And the people at like Daimler or Chrysler or Jeep or whatever they are now, they don't point to that and go, well, I mean, we made the Wagoneer in the, you know, 50s, 60s or 70s or whatever. So, you know, this is just like the Wagoneer. But it's not, because anybody who's ever like owned a car, you know what I mean? Like, you know the difference between these things. And it's interesting to me, our business in particular, how many choices that you have. And so standing outside of this business, you're like, I got an electric guitar and I plug it into an amp and I play. And then you got some guy that really does this stuff. And you're like, really? What'd you get? You know, and because, you know, I know what's going on with the, I know the difference between my car Viceroy and a Fender Deluxe and what I'm looking for with Boss pedals versus Earthquaker pedals or you know, whatever, Eventide, you know, how Strymon, how crazy you can get into details with things, you know. And I like it all, man. I think it's all just so fantastically interesting and so cool. And I love seeing like new brands pop up, and I'm really proud to be a part of this whole thing. And I'm glad that guys like you and I'm glad that enough people, you know, sort of respect what we do, that we're able to participate in this thing that's so interesting and keep it moving forward in little incremental ways, right?
Absolutely. What a wholesome sentiment to kind of wrap the podcast up on.
You know, respect for the past with a nod to the future, and respect for all of our contemporaries, like with a nod to the future, right? And that's what it should all be about, man. I mean, you know how cool it is to, you know, I forget, and I try to remind myself, and I love doing stuff like this with you guys, and I love going to guitar shows and talking to people, because I don't want to be like they're widgets, and I don't want to think about them like they're widgets. I don't want to worry about things like that. You know what I mean? And if these things are made to be played, and they're made to make music with, and take them and you know, beat them up and make music with them and enjoy them, you know, because that's what it's all about. Yeah. Boy, what a bunch of sappy.
Well,
but it's totally true, right? It's totally true.
And I think the one thing that I would like to ask before we wrap up is, in the last 25 years then of Reverend history, can you pick out one big highlight for you? One kind of like you would have never even dreamt that would have been possible when you first started, or when the company first started? Like, what's the big point for you that you're going, yep, that's why I did it, and that's why I'm still doing it now?
There's been a bunch, but if I had to pick one, the first time I visited England, boy, I hate to bring it right home to you guys, because that sounds contrived. It sounds so contrived, and this is not contrived. When I was a kid in the 80s, I was like, you know, I was punk rock alternative kid, and I was beat up a lot and called a lot of names. It wasn't glamorous. And, but I liked, you know, everybody says that, oh, I liked everything, but I did, man. I loved Iron Maiden, and I loved Coroner as every bit as much as I liked The Cure and Love and Rockets and the Bauhaus. And I loved Southern California, hardcore, then, you know, and Black Flag, and then the DC stuff, and Dag Nasty, and Bad Brains, and the New York stuff, and I liked everything. And but funny, looking back on the 80s, The Cure was not pop music in the 80s. The Cure was alternative music that girls with black hair and a lot of eye makeup liked, period. You know, and it wasn't until the 90s that they really became a pop band in the US. And so in the 80s, you know, when I was in high school and all my high school girlfriends all liked The Cure and the Depeche Mode, and I liked the guitar music and they liked that music. And then at some point, you know, I loved Tin Machine. And because I could never really understand what people saw in David Bowie, just to be honest, as a teenager, you know, and I liked all this different music. And David Bowie was always a part of the alternative music scene in the 80s. And people refer to David Bowie and love David Bowie. And I was like, I mean, yeah, it's cool. I don't have anything against it, but I don't really get it. You know, this is a time when he was doing that duet with Mick Jagger, right?
Yeah.
And so when Tin Machine came out, I was like, oh, I get it. David Bowie is awesome, right? And this Tin Machine band just hit me like a whole bunch of us. Like, wow, I can't believe he's doing that. And who the hell is that guitar player? And so then you flash forward almost 30 years to Penny and I flying over to England. I had never been to England as a guest of Reeves and The Cure, and going to see Cure at Wembley and going to soundcheck with those guys and eating at The Cure's catering, you know what I mean? And thinking to myself, like, 16-year-old me would look at 46-year-old me and be like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? And like, oh, wouldn't it be fun to go back to all the girls that I dated back then? And be like, hi, I'm talking to Robert Smith, you know? Like, it's so amazing. And that Reeves made it possible for us to be, you know, a part of that organization and to do that. And so standing at Wembley and watching The Cure from the side of the stage and watching my friend, Reeves Cabrels, playing Reverend guitars in that setting in such a legendary venue with such a hugely influential band. It was amazing. I mean, there's nothing like it.
Yeah,
I can't even describe the feeling, you know? So cool. And right there, and I've told the story with Watt. I had this similar experience with Watt. You know, the first time I saw Watt playing his signature bass, I just was, you know, young, you know, 16-year-old me just was freaking out, right? So that man, I can't describe the feeling to you guys to you know, go from being a fan to being a part of it is really, really special.
I can relate in similar things to what's happened to me. And I think you're right. There's something about, I think, like you said there, going back to your younger self, listening to that band and being like, don't worry, your time will come, you know, and it just being like, yeah, it's, you know, you couldn't have imagined, you know, listening to those bands and then saying, you know, thinking I'm going to be side of stage. It doesn't come into your thoughts really, because that feels impossible. And I think to be in the industry and do everything you've done and that to open up to you is just amazing. And again, it will just, you know, for anyone listening, hopefully they'll go, yeah, that's why he does it, and I can't wait for the next 25 years and he might have a different story then, you know. That's
another reason why, and I don't want to open up this whole can of worms either. That's another reason why the last couple of years were so hard, because the last couple of years, then we didn't have that interaction for a long time. And it took a long time for that interaction to start coming back. And it's still just coming back. You know what I mean? There's still times now where you're like, oh, I was just out on the road with my band for the first time in years. We did a couple of weeks here in the States, and I play in the ska band with one of the guys from the Suicide Machines. And we were out with this band called Big D and the Kids Table, and going out on the road and watching people watch bands. And being on stage is great too, but just being a part of it, it's just so, like, I don't know, man. It's just so important, you know? And I don't, you know, and it's so funny because I can't understand not understanding that. But then, you know, I don't understand a lot of sports ball either. So I get it. So, and when I look at people like being so like emotionally involved in, you know, football. And I'm like, okay, I'm glad they like it. I don't have anything against it. And I love going to sporting events because I'll get caught up in it when I'm there. You know, it's very easy to be excited about things. But then there's people that just don't, you know, to each his own. But this is the thing. Like, this is what we do. And just being able to be a part of it is exciting. And I strive really hard to never lose that feeling, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is a smart way to be, sir. I'm trying to get into American sports at the moment. The listeners will know I've been trying to learn about baseball so that I can get into baseball. But I'm not there yet, but it's gonna happen. I need more things to bet on.
You bring up baseball. I just had a huge talk about cricket yesterday with my dad on Father's Day here. And because in my mind, cricket was always like some sort of really like strangely more complicated baseball.
Yeah, it's baseball with cucumber sandwiches.
And it turns out that baseball is actually a lot more complicated cricket when you get right down to it.
Yeah, I'm struggling. I'm honestly struggling. There's more to baseball than I thought. I thought it was going to be like rounders, but you know, with cool clothes. But no, it's
So now, how do you guys feel about Formula One with Silverstone coming up next week?
Oh, yeah, that would be exciting. I don't know anything about Formula One. I know a couple of our good friend listeners are Formula One fans because I see people like Stuart Tate from Tate Effects always posting about it. So I know some people are into it. I don't know anything about it. I won some money on the whatever the one was the other day. I was yesterday. Yeah, I was on a train home. I had nothing to do. I placed a random bet on Lewis Hamilton getting on the podium in some way. And he did, apparently, because, you know, I won a tenner. So there we go.
Good for you.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah, that's gotten pretty popular in the U.S. One of the streaming platforms over here started doing, like, a documentary on it. And it's really, really taken off here. My family has always been automotive and Indy racing a lot. And I never really paid attention to Formula One until this thing started coming up. And now I find it to be quite a bit more interesting than American auto racing. And Penny's really into it. She knows stats and things that I don't even have a handle on. And so, yeah, we've been into it and we watch them all. And I have yet to attend a Formula One race. I've attended a lot of IndyCar races and NASCAR races in my lifetime, but I've never been to a Formula One race.
Yes. I did as a kid. It's very good. I used to be into it. I need to get back into it. You're making me excited about Formula One again, Ken. I'm going to have to.
I cannot comment on any sports. Actually, that's a lie. Snooker. But,
oh yeah.
Snooker, yeah.
When we were in the UK, I watched a lot of snooker on television over there. But I grew up at the pool hall down the street that had a regulation snooker table. And there were times when we would go to the pool hall and all the tables would be full and that would be the only one that nobody was playing on because nobody knew how to play. And so my friends and I learned how to play. And I'm not saying that I'm good at it, but I do play and really, really enjoy it. It's intense. It's a brilliant game, and it's very, very difficult to find here in the States. It's very difficult to find tables, and that pool hall that I was talking about still exists, and they removed that table to put in electric dartboards. Now,
boring.
I love darts, and I threw steel tip darts in leagues for years when I was a kid, and I'll play some cricket, and I love it. But to remove the snooker table for the electronic boards was a real kick in the butt. So when I come over there, we'll have to go play.
Yeah, that absolutely. Sounds great.
Right? I would love that. That would be awesome. And you guys are going to pummel me because it's been years, but at least I know how to play. You won't have to explain it to me.
He'll be fine. We can have some bets. We'll bet on a few games. Yeah, it's going to be great.
Well, listen, I'm going to need some sort of over-under if we're going to be betting, okay? Because I'm not betting on any sort of win here.
That's That sounds reasonable. Well, dear listener, that is all the time we have on this week's episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. You can, of course, join us on Patreon over at patreon.com/guitar nerds for an entire extra episode every week. You can become a Patreon supporter for as little as $1 a month. At the dollar tier, you get this episode ad-free and early. $5 gets you access to the Patreon special episodes, and $10 gets you the lot. Plus, I'll sing you my thanks at the end of every episode. You can find us on all your favorite social media platforms and join the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook to get involved in our weekly discussion. Ken, thank you so much for coming on and being a guest.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having me. And thanks again so much for the Guitar of the Year. That was awesome. That meant a lot to us and Greg. And we were thrilled when that, we weren't expecting that. We were like, what?
Absolutely. No worries. It was well deserved. We'll be back next week, dear listener, with more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
See ya.
Yeah.